There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesman-Ellen. I'm your host. On today's program, the Federal Trade Commission seems to be in favor of internet freedom. Radio might have to pay artists, and some Republicans want to reform the FCC. Oh, we're going to catch up with the news tonight. You do want to stay tuned. Well, before we get started tonight, I do want to say a big thanks to Eric Yarnell, ably holding down the controls. Actually, he's literally holding them down. We have no gravity in the on-air control room here at the studios of WNUR. He's been holding it down since March. Is that that's correct? Or April, I guess.
Yeah, well, it was April. I mean, it's been pretty hard. But hey, you know, it's radio. If it was easy, everybody'd be doing it, I guess.
Well, let's get right into things. You know, the Federal Trade Commission may start enforcing network neutrality, including taking action against internet service providers who don't make good on promises to consumers. That's according to FTC Chairman John Leibowitz, who recently made comments on the C-SPAN cable network. Leibowitz says that antitrust laws might be invoked if a major broadband provider blocks content that competes with its own or competes with content provided by one of its business partners. He said that the freedom to send and receive legal content on the internet without interference by broadband providers is a consumer protection issue. And consumer protection is one of the main functions of the Federal Trade Commission. He also said that it's important that broadband providers inform consumers about the speed of internet service that they receive and that they should be made aware of any network management tactics that affect their service. According to Leibowitz, this kind of transparency should also extend to billing. He expressed no criticism of broadband providers charging more for higher speeds or more throughput, provided that the plans are fairly marketed and consumers are made aware in advance of charges. I mean, that's kind of an interesting point. It's something which has been, you know, floating around in the background with the changeover to the Obama administration. And it's certainly been floating around at the FCC, putting into effect real enforceable policies that would make it illegal or provide penalties for internet service providers, which would block content or interfere with content to their customers. Comcast is most famously got caught for last year interfering with BitTorrent traffic on its network without telling consumers that it was happening. It's a file sharing application, a peer-to-peer application as it's known, that can be used for really making it less expensive to download large files, especially like software or other independent content. Indeed, you can get like the new Nine Inch Nails album freely downloaded from Nine Inch Nails, so not in any sort of pirate way, in a very high quality using this BitTorrent. But under Comcast's previous schemes, you would have been blocked. And one of the things that people are really concerned about, especially a lot of internet freedom activists, is that if Comcast has a deal with particular video content providers, it may come a day in which they block or degrade the performance of independent content, whether it's from YouTube or maybe from a different provider. And that's what we're looking to get ahead of. But with the new Obama administration, it seems to be much friendlier to the principles of network neutrality, not necessarily trusting the market to be the enforcing agent, and to see the Federal Trade Commission step up into the void, which has been incredibly otherwise pro-industry under the Bush administration, seems like a fairly positive sign. So that's some pretty good news there. But as the fortunes of commercial radio continue to swirl around the bowl, the battle over radio's relationship to the music it plays is heating up. On May 13th, the House Judiciary Committee voted 21-9 to approve the Performance Rights Act. This bill would compel broadcasters to pay royalties to singers, musicians, and other performers when their recordings are played on air. Currently, radio stations pay royalties to the songwriters, but radio has been exempt from performers' royalties for over a half century. Satellite radio, internet broadcasters, and European broadcasters do not enjoy this exemption. Major record labels, major recording artists, and even the grassroots musicians advocacy group, the Future Music Coalition, have been lobbying in support of the Performance Rights Act, arguing that the loophole exempting radio from performance royalties is antiquated. The original justification for the exemption was that radio was believed to perform an important promotional role for recorded music. However, the decline of radio's prominence and fortunes combined with a decline in music sales seems to be turning that tide. Independent artists and those recording for small labels in particular dispute the promotional value of commercial radio. The independents argue that their music is barely played by stations to begin with. For instance, a recent study by the Future Music Coalition found that 51% of adult contemporary stations' playlists were songs from before 1999. Since new releases are the primary beneficiaries from radio play, this heavy reliance on older songs indicates that some half of the artists are not deriving much benefits from airplay. For its part, the National Association of Broadcasters, which represents commercial radio, says that the promotional value of radio shouldn't be so easily dismissed. Broadcasters also say that having to pay the royalty will only further hurt the commercial radio business, with their profits already suffering due to declining ad revenue. The Judiciary Committee also approved an amendment offered by Chairman John Conyers, which would reduce fees paid by small stations with annual revenue under $500,000. Non-commercial stations would pay the lowest rate of $500 per year, while talk and religious stations would be exempt from the new fees. Civil rights groups, including the Rainbow Push Coalition, have been pressing Conyers to delay action on the bill until a hearing is held to investigate the possible effect on minority-owned stations. That pressure likely influenced his amendment, lowering the cost for smaller stations. Even so, a fellow Democrat, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, noted that the bill is, quote, a work in progress, end quote. The Performance Rights Act now goes to the House floor for a full vote. That's a venue where the National Association of Broadcasters expects it will have a better chance of killing it. And a companion bill is heading for the Senate. Now, I was glad to hear out of this, finally, some numbers mentioned for non-commercial radio. That was probably my personal greatest concern about such a bill, about such an action being taken, since non-commercial radio stations often have almost no revenue, depending on their funding model. And even an additional several thousand dollars could be a relatively significant burden. I'd also argue that when it comes to promoting independent music, in particular, non-commercial stations, college stations, community stations, and many public stations fulfill that role likely much better than commercial radio does, highlighting underplayed artists, challenging artists, artists flying under the mainstream, artists who likely, you know, would really get no airplay. And often I think owe their careers to the existence of these stations. Nevertheless, on the flip side, a lot of folks probably don't realize that radio stations already pay royalties to songwriters. And this is due to action by ASCAP and BMI, which are two large rights advocacy organizations that represent songwriters and collect royalties from all broadcasters every year. College stations, community stations, public stations often pay these royalties through negotiated plans that they've worked out en masse with the ASCAP and BMI, which are figured out during reporting periods when stations are actually required to turn in survey playlists for a certain period where they help to calculate. It's not a pure survey manner. So when, you know, a station like community station or WNUR doesn't turn in every playlist and then, you know, calculated, you know, 5 cents for this play, 1 cent for this play, or anything like that, so much as that they figure out, you know, top plays or whatever, and everyone gets some royalties based upon that. Some critics of the plan for the performance royalties being paid by radio stations point out that SoundScan, which is the organization which collects these same royalties from internet stations. So internet stations are not at all exempt. And in fact, current broadcast stations, if you have an FM broadcast station playing music and also an internet feed of that same station, the broadcaster will pay the royalties for the internet feed. SoundScan is the organization which collects the royalties and is supposed to distribute them to the artists. SoundScan sort of notoriously says it can't often find fairly prominent artists such as the German krautrock group Kraftwerk, which still records and performs in tours. That's one artist that they've noted that they can't find to pay the royalties to. I'll give a hint. Look in Germany. That might help them out a lot. So there's a little bit of concern that the royalties may be collected, but not actually fairly paid out to the artists in question. There's also concerns that the royalties will primarily go to the Recording Industry Association of America, which often owns the performance rights to the recordings which they publish. The rights holding on music can be a pretty in-depth and difficult thing to tease out. But to bring out a fairly prominent example, none of the Beatles, surviving or otherwise, owns the rights to any of the songs which they recorded for Capitol back in the 60s. So when one of their songs gets licensed for commercial or played on the radio or played in any other venue, none of that money goes to any of the surviving Beatles. It goes to the person who holds the rights, which used to be Michael Jackson owned all the rights to the Beatles recordings. Not entirely sure. I might actually have that backwards. It might be the songs. So there's other rights which you own when you write the songs themselves and you collect royalties on that. So I might actually have that backwards on the Beatles. It may be that the Beatles actually own the recordings, but not the songs. They sold them off at some point. But very often when you are a recording artist, you sign away the rights to the recordings you make for a particular record label, or you sign away some portion of it. You only get a portion of it. The record label retains these performance royalties ostensibly because they funded your records, even though in reality you often pay that money back, meaning you don't really get a check from the record label until you sold enough CDs to pay for whatever costs were incurred in the recording promotion of your record. But that's a whole nother set of issues there regarding this issue of performance royalties being paid by radio stations. I will say it doesn't come at a very good time for radio, where the major radio conglomerates have their stock prices in the penny stock range, coming down from heights of into as high as $30 to $40, $50, $60 a share. It's not a real good time for radio, but it's also not a very good time for the recording industry, and it seems as though a lot of those chickens are coming home to roost for the likes of Clear Channel and so on. I just recently, in fact, recently as in yesterday, finished reading a book that just came out in paperback by a reporter journalist named Alec Foga, I think that's how you pronounce his name, called Right of the Dial, and is a history, a very sordid history of Clear Channel from its beginnings until going and being sold to a private equity group about a year or so ago. And I'm hoping to get Alec Foga on the air here for an interview. I've got some feelers out for that. I would love to talk with him and learn more. And I do have scheduled an interview probably in 2 weeks here with Jerry Del Culiano, who was once the publisher of a weekly radio industry news sheet called Inside Radio, who was an early critic of Clear Channel going back to the mid-90s, before Clear Channel then basically started to slander him and couldn't dispute the facts that he was reporting on, so instead went on to slander him before buying the publication he worked for, basically putting him out of business. He then went on to become an instructor at USC, at University of Southern California, and now runs his own blog, which is great. If you want to hear the sort of details of how messed up commercial radio is on a daily basis, you want to read insidemusicmedia.blogspot.com. And I actually had a chance to talk on the phone with Jerry about a week ago, and the man is passionate. He is really putting these things together, and I hope to have him on the show in about 2 weeks so we can explore a little bit better. And I think I'll have a question for Jerry about what he thinks about this issue of radio having to pay royalties on music played. I'm sure he'll have some opinions about it. And this is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel, and I am your host. You can check out Media Geek online at mediageek.net. The radio show is at radio.mediageek.net. You can subscribe to the podcast, listen in your browser, or just download the MP3, however you want to do it. Radio.mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. You can send them to me while the show's on the air, or send them to me later. I'd love to hear it. And if you are on the Twitter and you want to converse that way, go to twitter.com/MediaGeek.
Well, Paul, if I may interject.
Sure.
I definitely agree that the promotional aspect to radio has long since left. And you were talking about, I think it was an alternative station that played most of their music from before 1999.
And that's not alternative. It's adult contemporary.
Adult contemporary.
Yeah, I mean, that's not one station. That's actually the Future Music Coalition went ahead and did a survey, a really big study on what music commercial radio stations in major formats are playing. The reason why they did this is that there was actually a settlement made between the major commercial broadcasters over the payola scandal of a couple years ago, where it was revealed that radio stations were still taking lots of money in payment to put play songs on air. In exchange, the broadcasters agreed to play a better variety of music and more independent music. So the Future Music Coalition was going to take them to task, release a study at the end of April, and basically found there's been almost no change since that happened. And part of their analysis was that they're still grinding on the same old oldies.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, part of the whole promotional machine of radio, say top 40 or even contemporary rock radio, has been that they really highlight the newest music, and that's what people tend to get excited about, and that is more likely, it's thought, to generate sales, whereas playing the same old soft rock standards is less likely to motivate someone to run out and go dig through the bins at Walmart, to pick up some great mellow rock of the 70s.
Well, and you probably already have it. You know, if you really like the song, you probably... You know, already
yeah,
have.
or hearing it 30 times a day on the adult contemporary station already satiates your desire.
But an artist such as Bob Dylan putting out new music, obviously well established, mm-hmm. decades ago. But I mean, his new music doesn't have a chance of getting on.
Exactly. I mean, that's always the irony. And we'll go ahead and take a call here. We have Mark from Chicago.
Great. I don't have to pay for this call, do I?
You didn't call a 1-900 number, did you?
I'm not promoting any records, so I guess I'm cool.
Yeah, it's totally cool. So, were you calling in to talk about the radio paying royalties on that?
Yeah, I was picking up on your point about the radio stations sort of all having the not playing enough new music.
Yeah,
you know, I'm 52 years old, and I listen all the time to hear new music all over the place. And every time I go through a radio station in Chicago, I'm hearing basically the Allman Brothers, and, you know, which is, isn't that the equivalent of, you know, listening to music from the 30s and 40s, you know, for, I don't know, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been sort of like, yeah, exactly, listening to the music of the 30s and 40s during the 1960s.
No,
if you were in a Summer of Love, hearing, basically listening to swing.
I disagree with that because it's still rock and roll. I mean, that's like, that's like somebody, in Wagner's day listening to Mozart. I mean, that's not that bad.
Yeah, but Wagner, man, he kicks. Well, I guess I can see that point, but, you know... The music has to be something that continues to evolve as different people pick it up, listen to it, process it, and play it. And I think that's what needs to be heard. Is, you know, you listen to, you go back to, you know, the 60s and people like Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and all those guys. And, you know, suddenly they became the benchmark and everybody wanted to play like them. And then there was, punk, and punk was a wonderful. That punk was my generation. It came mm-hmm. out, and it was like, do it yourself. Play some music you want to hear, and it was processing that stuff. And then, I think we had the dark period of disco and, you know, and alternative. And then gradually what happens is each one kind of solidifies into a product, into a set, you know. I mean,
into like a genre. They become its own. It becomes its own sort of genre, its own movement.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Grunge became was really fresh and exciting, and suddenly it was, well, you got to have a flannel shirt, you got to have your guitar detuned, you know, and it became another formula. So I guess the question is, where and how do we hear new music?
Well, I mean, I think that's that a lot of folks would argue right now with the internet. Radio would argue to some extent. The internet, and it poses itself as a challenge, as a competitor, and that's why they need relief.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where a lot of folks come from. I know, Eric is a current college student, and mm-hmm. I mean, where are your peers getting new music?
Where are they getting new music?
Well, are they hearing it? Or are they learning about it?
The thing is, and I probably get a lot of flack for this, but even I think young artists coming out are in a sense copying the previous styles of music.
Well, sure. Sure.
So,
you always have something to build on. I mean, if you look at the guys back in the '60s, they built on the blues artists that they had heard, and the, you know, the musicians of the '50s, and then they built on, you know, the country music of the '40s and the soul music, and they kind of combined that. And, you know, so sure, you always have your sources. Mm-hmm. I mean, you hear something growing up, or your parents listen to something, or there's a, you know, something informs how you hear music and what you hear. So
Mark, where do you hear music? Where do you hear your new music? Where do you go for it?
Oh, really? What I like, I look for mashups. I love mashups because it's kind of like you take two things that you've heard a million times and put them together in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jimmy James did a great one with, I think it was Jimmy James, with Sgt. Pepper and Guns N' Roses. So it's the music.
Right. Where do you find this? I mean, are you hearing it on the radio?
No.
You're hearing right on the internet, probably, correct?
You gotta find it on the web, yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think about this? About stations now having to, you know, possibly by law having to pay artists, you know, so that maybe perhaps the next time that that Everyone Must Get Stoned gets played, nickel or so goes to Bob Dylan instead of right now. It's ostensibly to say Dylan gets enough exposure from that play.
Okay, well, let's look at the model for the way artists get paid for their music. You know, a CD could be, let's just say $15, just as a rough number. And out of that, the artist gets a dollar, maybe after they've recouped their expenses.
Something like that. Depends on your deal. You know, if you're or Bob Dylan, you usually get more.
Sure.
If you're a new artist who just put out their first CD, likely less.
I think most people are pro-artist, anti-record company in general.
So you're saying there, Mark, that it's a good thing then, or that, you know, that probably artists do have some more money coming to them.
Well, no, I would say the artists, sure, anytime artists get money, that's great because that allows them to keep, you know, creating their art and not having to do crappy day jobs like I do.
Or a lot of them do both.
Yes, that's true. I think the thing is, the record companies and the distributions and stuff, distributors and the retailers and stuff, why not have them absorb some of the cost? But then do we get back in? Does that push us back into payola?
Yeah, well, I mean, that is really the question.
Kind of
I mean, the argument right now is that, you know, other media, including satellite radio, internet radio now, are having to pay these royalties, so why not broadcast?
Sure, like some of the web radio stations. And
mm-hmm.
AccuRadio.com, I think, has been pretty active. AccuRadio.com is a station that I was as a,
okay.
a website. I was. It's got a lot of different stations and hear a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That you wouldn't hear otherwise.
Well, Mark, thanks for tuning in and thanks for giving me a call.
And, great, I appreciate.
Thanks for letting us.
I guess the other resource is live music. Get out there and see some live music. Pick up an instrument, bang on it yourself, and live large.
Absolutely.
Right,
if you listen to Media Geek, you are living large. Have a good night, Mark.
All right. Peace out.
And here's a story that comes from the Center for Media and Democracy at PRWatch.org. The continuing saga of the Pentagon Pundit program keeps getting curiouser and curiouser as Alice in Wonderland might say. From 2002 to 2008, the Defense Department secretly cultivated more than 70 retired military officers who frequently serve as media commentators. Initially, the goal was to use them as message force multipliers to bolster the Bush administration's Iraq War sell job. That went so well that the covert program to shape U.S. public opinion, an illegal effort by any reasonable reading of the law, was expanded to spin everything from then-Defense Secretary Rumsfeld's job performance to U.S. military operations in Afghanistan to the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center to warrantless wiretapping. In April 2008, shortly after the New York Times first reported on the Pentagon's pundits, an in-depth expose that recently won the Times' David Barstow his second Pulitzer Prize, the Pentagon suspended the program. In January 2009, the Defense Department Inspector General's office released a report claiming, quote, there was an insufficient basis to conclude that the program had violated laws, end quote. Representative Paul Hodes, one of the program's many congressional critics, called the Inspector General's report a whitewash. Now it seems as though the Pentagon agrees. On May 5th, the Defense Department Inspector General's office announced that it was withdrawing its report on the Pentagon Pundit program, even removing the file from its website. You can still see that over at prwatch.org. Quote, shortly after publishing the report, we became aware of inaccuracies in the data, end quote, states the withdrawal memo from the Inspector General's office. The office's internal review of the report, which it has refused to release, according to the Times, concluded that the report did not meet accepted quality standards. The report relied on insufficient or inconclusive evidence, the memo admits. In addition, former senior Defense Department officials who advised and managed the Pentagon Pundit program, including Victoria Clark and Lawrence DeRita, refused their request for an interview. While the Inspector General's highly unusual about-face is welcome, it gets us no closer to accountability. The withdrawal memo states, quote, additional investigative work will not be undertaken because the Pentagon Pundit program has been terminated and responsible senior officials are no longer employed by the department, end quote. Of course, accountability for the Pentagon Pundit program was never likely to come from the Defense Department itself. Now it's up to Congress to demand and the Government Accountability Office and the FCC to carry out real investigations into the elaborate propaganda campaign, and that comes from prwatch.org. And I hope to have Diane Farsetta, who is the lead researcher at PR Watch, back on the program in the coming weeks. She came on in December to talk about their end of the year Falsies Award for momentous achievements in spreading falsity via public relations in 2008. And she can catch us up on some other stories they're keeping track of. We'll have her on Media Geek in the coming weeks. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in 1 week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. The radio show is at radio.MediaGeek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@MediaGeek.net. And follow the Twitter feed, asking questions. Want your input, want your reflection, your answers. Trying to make this more interactive, go to twitter.com/MediaGeek. Thanks for tuning in.